It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station, broadcasting from snowy Signal Hill here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it's 33 degrees, and the National Weather Service is warning of hazardous weather conditions because of the snow that's coming down all around us. We're looking for more snow, mainly before 3. The high about 36 today. Northeast wind 15 miles per hour will turn to the north and go to 20 miles per hour this afternoon and could gust as high as 30. Your chance of precipitation, well, it's going to happen. Total daytime snow accumulation of less than a half of an inch. That might be a little off. For tonight, a 20% chance of snow before 9 p.m. Cloudy skies tonight with a low of about 24. Northwest wind 30 miles per hour, gusting as high as 40 tonight. Coming up on the Midday News, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is looking for a public comment as they look at dismantling Alaska's first and only nuclear power plant. Families of four passengers killed in a mid-air crash suing the estate of Gary Knopp, the former Alaska state representative.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The administration is doubling down on its warning to states to refrain from lifting coronavirus restrictions, such as mask mandates, prematurely, not when the United States could be just months away from having enough vaccines for the whole country. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky announced at today's coronavirus response briefing that COVID-19 cases and deaths are still too high. Case numbers are fluctuating between 60,000 and 70,000 each day, and she says new research underscores the risks of fully reopening restaurants too soon.
Increases in daily death rates of COVID-19 cases and deaths grew more quickly within 40 to 80 days following restaurants being allowed to resume on-premises dining.
Despite the CDC's warnings, more states are opting to lift in-dining restrictions on restaurants that have been hit especially hard in the last year. This week, Texas and Mississippi announced complete rollbacks of their COVID-19 mitigation measures. Reacting to their decision to rescind their mask mandates, President Joe Biden said the decision in the face of so many COVID deaths amounted to, quote, Neanderthal thinking. Today in Texas, state regulators decided not to lower the cost of electricity in the days following last month's blackout in the state. Mose Bushell of member station KUT reports the decision has sweeping implications for Texas ratepayers and electric companies.
During and after the blackout, a megawatt hour of electricity skyrocketed to the highest allowable price, $9,000. Retail electric providers are now going bankrupt from having to pay that much. The cost will also mean higher bills for customers. But today, the Public Utility Commission of Texas said going back and lowering that price would bring uncertainty to the market and cause even more pain. Some power companies and utilities made money selling electricity in the blackout. They opposed the repricing. Texas lawmakers have said protecting customers from higher bills is a priority. For NPR News, I'm Mose Bushell in Austin.
The Biden administration is promising to work with Congress to replace decades-old authorizations for the use of military force that many lawmakers have long criticized as overly broad. Here's NPR's Scott Detrow.
Over the years, there's been a growing push from lawmakers in both parties to repeal and rewrite laws granting presidents power to launch military operations without needing additional approval from Congress. Those demands returned after Biden ordered targeted airstrikes in Syria last week. Many Democrats, including Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, criticized the move. Now, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the administration will work with Congress to replace the older, broader authorizations with what she called, quote, a narrow and specific framework that's aimed at terrorist threats. Scott Detrow, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow closes up 570 points. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
The Kodiak Area Emergency Operations Center reported yesterday that five new COVID cases, previously unknown from February, were individuals, non-resident seafood workers who remained off-island, tested off-island, and isolated off-island during the duration of their isolation period. The cases were tested between February 10th and February 13th. This brings the total case count to 1,066 cases, 1066, locally since the start of the pandemic, with only one case classified as active locally. There have been 42 local hospitalizations and five deaths due to COVID-19 locally to date. There are no active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has issued a document that outlines plans to decommission and dismantle Alaska's first and only nuclear power plant, the old SM-1A, at Fort Greely. The Corps has scheduled two meetings for next week to talk about the draft environmental assessment, and it's encouraging the public to comment on it. KUAC's Tim Ellis has this report.
Army officials shut down the SM-1A back in 1972 after 10 years of operation and partially dismantled and mothballed the facility until they could figure out what to do with it. The Corps of Engineers now proposes to remove what's left of the old power plant in a draft environmental assessment released last week that it'll share with the public on Tuesday in Fairbanks and Thursday in Delta Junction.
We wanted to make sure that we were hosting the meetings in Fairbanks and in Delta in order to try to encourage more public participation.
Project manager Brenda Barber heads up a team from the Corps' Baltimore office that's been studying whether and how to dismantle and remove the remainder of the nuclear power plant. The draft environmental assessment examines the impacts of dismantling the facility, a complex project that would take years to complete.
We are targeting a mobilization to the site in the April of 2023 timeframe, with a target completion date of 2028.
The SM-1A was a field prototype of a medium-sized nuclear reactor the Army was developing during the Cold War for use at remote military installations. It generated 20 megawatts of thermal energy for steam heat and 1.8 megawatts of electricity. Some components were removed from the plant after it was shut down, as explained by Brian Hardy, the Corps of Engineers Deactivated Nuclear Power Plant Program Manager, in a 2018 interview.
All of the fuel in the reactor core was removed. Any of the highly activated control and absorber rods were also removed. All of the solid waste around the reactor was packaged up and shipped down to waste disposal facilities in the lower 48.
Hardy says some of the plant's primary system components, including the reactor and its pressure vessel and coolant pumps, were entombed inside the facility.
Those were either kept in place or they were cut off and laid down in the bottom of the tall vapor containment building there. And then they were grouted and concreted in place.
Hardy said those procedures reduced the amount of radiation emitted by those components to a level that's considered safe. And he says the site's been continuously monitored ever since. Those safeguards protect the workers at the heat and power plant that now runs on diesel-fired boilers. Barber says before the radioactive components can be removed from the site, the contractor that'll eventually be hired for the project must disconnect the steam heat system from the SM-1A.
This is a very large and unique project, and so we really do want that participation. We want comments from the public.
Barber says people may attend next week's meeting in person at the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks or Delta Junction Community Center, or they can find out how to participate online by going to Fort Greely's Facebook page. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The families of four passengers killed in a mid-air crash last summer are suing the estate of Gary Knopp, the former Alaska state representative who was piloting the plane that collided with theirs. Representatives for Kristen Wright, Caleb Halsey, McKay Halsey, and Heather Halsey, all of South Carolina, filed two separate lawsuits yesterday against Knopp's estate and his wife, Helen Knopp. Both suits also target the estate of Gregory Bell, the charter pilot who also died in the crash, and the two companies that owned and operated that charter plane, High Adventure Air Charters and Soldotna Aircraft and Equipment Leasing. Knopf's private plane collided with the charter plane carrying Wright and the Halseys above Soldotna last July, killing Knopf and all six on board the charter. Caleb and McKay were brothers. Wright and Heather Halsey were their partners. The National Transportation Safety Board later found that Knopp was denied a medical certification from the Federal Aviation Administration in 2012 because of vision problems. FAA regulations require a medical certificate to fly. That's outlined in the complaint attached to one of the lawsuits filed by William Halsey, who's the father of the two brothers, according to an online obituary. The other lawsuit was filed by Wright's parents. William Halsey's complaint alleges that Knopp was negligent in his operation of the aircraft because he was flying without a valid medical certificate. It also alleges negligence against Helen Knopp, saying that she knew or should have known about her husband's vision problems. Max Schneider is the lawyer for the Halseys. He says it's more efficient to make claims against all the defendants at once rather than one by one.
Both of these pilots had an obligation to see and avoid each other. Both had some opportunity, as we understand the facts, to do that.
Last summer, officials said an investigation into the crash could take a year or more. A third suit was filed in Anchorage Superior Court last week against the Knopp estate on behalf of the estate of David Rogers, a Kansas guide who also died in the crash, and his wife, Rhonda Rogers. That suit does not target Gregory Bell or the charter plane operators. Attorney David Gross says Rogers settled with those parties late last year. He says the details of the settlement were confidential. Bell and Helen Knopp couldn't be reached immediately for comment. The state has lost an Alaskan Native leader. Former Interior State Legislator John Sackett died Wednesday in Anchorage from complications during heart surgery. Born in 1944, Sackett was raised in the Huslia and Koyukuk River region and went on to attend the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In 1966, at age 21, he became president of the Tanana Chiefs Conference and won a seat in the state house, becoming the youngest person ever elected to the state legislature. Later switching to the Senate, Sackett represented the interior until 1986. In a 1991 Fairbanks Native Association interview, he highlighted his 18 years on the Finance Committee, including 10 as chairman during Alaska's oil revenue boom years.
We used a tremendous amount of these funds to meet the daily requirements of human people out in the rural areas to put in better airports, roads, health facilities, schools, everything that's just the basic necessities. And I feel proud of that.
Sackett also served as founding president and chairman of the Interior Regional Alaska Native Corporation, DOYAN, and on the University of Alaska Board of Regents. Governor Dunleavy has ordered flags to fly at half-staff in Alaska Monday in honor of John Sackett. On Thursday, the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee voted to advance Congresswoman Deb Haaland's nomination as Interior Secretary to a full Senate vote. The committee passed the nomination 11-9, with two Republican senators who voted in favor of Haaland, including Senator Lisa Murkowski. KYUK's Olivia Eberts has more.
In Alaska, Lisa Murkowski finds herself caught between the enthusiasm of her indigenous constituents and her support for fossil fuels.
I've decided to support this nomination today, to support the first Native American who will hold this position, and with the expectation that Representative Haaland will be true to her word, not just on matters relating to Native peoples, but also responsible resource development and every other issue.
Many Alaska Natives support Deborah Haaland's historic nomination, regardless of where they stand on resource extraction. Last week, more than 100 Alaska Native women from all over the state co-authored a letter declaring their support for Haaland's nomination, citing massive underrepresentation of Indigenous leadership at the helm of this crucial department. If confirmed, Haaland would become the first Indigenous Interior Secretary, a position with the most oversight over U.S. relations with tribes. but Murkowski has made it her mission to see oil fields like the North Slope's Willow Project through. As a representative, Holland was opposed to projects like this, but has said as Interior Secretary she'll be working at President Biden's behest. Murkowski says it was a tough choice. She deliberated long and hard, listened, and asked many questions during the 2 days of confirmation hearings last month. She's also met with Holland on two occasions since then. But in the end, the historic nature of Holland's nomination won out. Holland's nomination is likely to pass in the Democrat-led Senate, where just a simple majority vote is needed. Alaska's other senator, Dan Sullivan, has not said whether he will support Holland in the full Senate vote. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Anchorage's Brother Francis Shelter will have more than half its guests fully vaccinated by next week. Lisa Aquino, head of the Catholic Social Services, which runs the shelter, says residents have been very willing to take the vaccine. A survey of shelter guests in January showed that 80% either had a plan to get or were interested in being vaccinated. Brother Francis also provided education about the vaccine, which he says helped make people make the decision.
So we did presentations. We had the providers from South Central Foundation give talks. Our staff received training so they could talk one-on-one with our guests at Brother Francis Shelter, answering their questions about the vaccine.
About a dozen shelter guests, age 65 and up, were able to be vaccinated when the first round opened in January. After the state opened vaccines to shelters last month, South Central Foundation stepped in to administer shots at the Brother Francis Clinic. Here's shelter director David Rittenberg.
We signed a whole bunch of people up for it, brought in snacks and music for people waiting while they're observed, and just sort of, you know, really tried to make a big deal out of the event.
The shelter has a capacity of 72 guests, and turnover has been relatively low during the pandemic. Rittenberg says that makes it easier to track down people for their second shots. After outbreaks this fall that led to multiple hospitalizations and at least one death in the homeless community, Rittenberg says he's hopeful that vaccines are starting to turn things around.
It feels like we're on the cusp of getting out of this thing. You know, there's still some work to do, but, you know, I'm hopeful and optimistic that we are on the path to get our community out.
Rittenberg says the shelter may hold regular vaccine clinics if demand is high. After 45 days without potable running water, the people in the village of Taluksek are finally able to drink from a local source. A fire destroyed the community's water purification plant and washateria in mid-January, and since then, residents have been living on donations of bottled water. Until this week, that is, KYUK's Olivia Eberts has more.
On Tuesday, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation was finally able to restore continuous access to drinking water in Taluksek with a reverse osmosis water filtration system. Several weeks ago, YKHC started piping river water to the school, but that water is not considered drinkable. A pump pulls up water from the Taluksek River to the school, where villagers can also do laundry thanks to machines donated through a GoFundMe. The new RO filtration system expands on that pumping system. Here's Cindy Christian. She's the project manager for the state's Department of Environmental Conservation's drinking water program.
It goes through a series of filters to filter out any kind of contamination. And then it goes through an RO treatment, which further treats it. And then the water from the RO is going to be chlorinated so that it is disinfected and it can be used for all purposes, including drinking water.
With the RO system in place, the State Department of Environmental Conservation's boil water order has been lifted, meaning residents no longer have to rely on the river or donated water to survive. Before the system was in place, if residents didn't have bottled water on hand, they either had to collect and haul water or ice from the nearby Taluksek River or the farther away Kuskokwim. In the past, residents have complained about the water quality of the Taluksek River, calling it unsafe to drink, even when boiled. Villagers have only a few hours each day when they can fill their bottles with drinking water. The village also has some remaining water from prior donations. The reverse osmosis system is intended to be a bonus holdover until YKHC can install a longer-term system. The next piece of the puzzle is a temporary water purification plant. The plant will restore potable water to all watering points in Tulooksac instead of just one fill station at the school. Here's Brian Lefferts. He's the Director of Environmental Health and Engineering at YKHC.
Reverse osmosis units are pretty energy intensive systems, and their filters are very expensive to replace. And so by bringing this water treatment plant up to Tulooksac, we then can provide potable water to that entire system.
That entire system refers to the school, teacher housing, and a temporary washateria. Tulooksac never had running water to individual homes to begin with. Once YKHC fully decommissions and winterizes the plant, the Bethel-based company Faulkner & Walsh will send it upriver and install it. Co-owner Steve Walsh says it will take a while to prepare and weeks to install once it's there.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to do in Tulooksac, and there's not a lot of infrastructure there.
They'll have to first widen the ice road to move the structure, and they anticipate continuing the work even beyond breakup.
Latter part of March, of course, the sun comes out and the solar radiation affects the ice road quite a bit. And so, yeah, we've got to get everything up there. And then once you get it to Tulooksac, then you can work around that. We anticipate that we'll have some equipment that we'll have to demold by barge.
Tulooksac will have to wait several years before a permanent structure can be put in place. But funding for it has already been secured. Last month, the Indian Health Service announced they will fund the lion's share of the $6.7 million replacement facility. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Halibut opens tomorrow. I'll tell you more after this.
Halibut and black cod buyers and sellers, simplify your sales online from one location at the Seafood Auction. Visit seafoodauction.net.
The Pacific halibut fishery opens tomorrow, and increased catches, combined with a cautiously optimistic outlook for the near future, have fanned interest in buying shares of the fish. Total halibut removals for 2021 were increased by 6.5% to 39 million pounds for all users and as bycatch in fisheries of the West Coast, British Columbia, and Alaska. Doug Bowen runs Alaska Boats and Permits in Homer.
It's great to see them turn around and come back. Maybe not as high as they were 15 years ago, but at least turn around and start seeing some increases in the catch limits for the next few years. People are very hopeful and very happy to see they're going to see some more pounds on their permits this year.
Alaska's roughly 2,000 fishermen get the largest chunk at 19.6 million pounds, and all regions except for the Bering Sea will see increased catches. Bowen adds the optimism is pushing up prices for halibut quota shares.
People have more confidence in the resource, and you know they're hoping to get a good accessible price. So yeah, we're seeing more demand, and that is pushing the prices up a bit. Certainly nowhere near the levels that they were a few years ago.
In 2017, for example, Central Gulf quota shares at more than $65 per pound are now closer to $45. At Southeast, quota that topped $70 are now listed in the $45 to high $50 range per pound. What the fish fetches at the docks is another part of the equation. Alaska faces increased competition from eastern Canada, Russia, and even farmed halibut from Norway.
With all that, we still saw pretty decent ex-vessel prices last year. I think in Homer we probably averaged $4.50 a pound for the whole season there. And you know, considering the pandemic and the economy and all that, that was probably a pretty good ex-vessel price, and we're hoping to see a good price again this year.
Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the fifth day of March, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 7:55 and it will set again at 6:50, giving us 11 hours exactly of daylight. That is a gain of 4 minutes and 59 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high was 48 degrees set in 1944. Our record low was minus 6 set in 1971. Currently 31 degrees, gotten a little cooler. We're looking for more of this snow continuing this afternoon, at least until 3 p.m. A high near 36 today. Northeast wind to 15 miles per hour, should turn to the north and go to 20 miles per hour this afternoon, and could gust as high as 30. Chance of precipitation is 80%. I think that's pretty much happening. And they're saying total daytime snow accumulation less than half an inch is possible, and we certainly have that. For tonight, a 20% chance of snow before 9 p.m. Cloudy skies tonight, low around 24. Northwest wind to 30 miles per hour, gusting as high as 40 tonight. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A 992 millibar low, 60 nautical miles south of Sitkanak, will exit the southern Gulf at 992 millibars by Saturday morning. A 993 millibar low in the North Pacific will move to 80 nautical miles southwest of Yakutat by Saturday morning, then dissipate 110 nautical miles southeast of Middleton Island at 1,000 millibars by Sunday morning. Result of all that, Kodiak's east side offshore, Marmot Island to Sitkanak, gale warning through Saturday. South winds to 25 knots right now, will increase to 45 knots to the northwest this afternoon. And north of Dangerous Cape, look for southeast 25. Seas to 16 feet, except 8 feet north of Dangerous Cape. For tonight, northwest winds to 45 knots and seas to 15 feet. For tomorrow, northwest winds to 35 knots, seas to 14 feet on our east side. Over on the west side in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through Saturday. North wind to 30 knots right now, seas to 7 feet. For tomorrow, northwest winds to 25 knots and seas to 6 feet, with freezing spray tonight and tomorrow in the Shelikof. Well, if you haven't dropped off your Kodiak Island Trails Network movie, you have to do that today. And they can be dropped off on a thumb drive at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Salmon Reception Desk. Don't forget, 486-1871. Ask for Philip for more information. Tomorrow is sales tax-free day in Kodiak. Sales tax will not be charged, and many of our local merchants will be participating in this great event, meaning they won't charge you. The Kodiak Chamber of Commerce would like to encourage everyone to take advantage of these savings, along with other great sales that many businesses will have tomorrow. And I'd like to say thank you to the City of Kodiak. Remember, when you shop Kodiak, you save Kodiak.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181. Fax us at 486-2733 or email psa@kmxt.org.